We are broadcasting.
Thank you. Welcome, everyone. I will call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order, and we will start by calling the roll. So please call the roll.
Senator Findley.
Senator Findley present by video.
Senator Riley.
Present by video.
Senator Wagner.
Present by video.
Vice Chair Boquist.
Present by video.
Madam Chair Burdick.
Present by video. Okay, today is going to be an unusual day thanks to technology. As you'll recall, last week we had a public hearing on Senate Bill 727, and it was a very informative public hearing. Unfortunately, for the purposes of our record keeping, the hearing never existed because it was not recorded and it was not streamed. So we are going to have to do two things today. We'll be having the public hearing on Senate Bill 727 to update and describe the amendment, but we will also be going over the same ground we covered in the original hearing, because some very important issues were raised, especially by Senator Findley. And so we will be accomplishing both of those things today. So I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 727.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So just to refresh everybody's memory, the dash one replaces the bill. The initial bill is just a placeholder study bill. And what the dash one does in effect is it's in response to the SALT limitation, state and local tax deduction limitation on personal income tax filers that Congress created in the Tax Cut and Jobs Act of 2017. What the dash one does is it creates a new entity level tax for pass-through entities, and it's an elective tax. And for the businesses that choose to pay that tax, the owners of the business then each get their pro rata share of that tax liability as a tax credit against their personal income tax returns. What this effectively does is move tax liability from the individual business owners to the business entity. And in federal law, the taxes paid by the entity are fully deductible against income. And with the tax credit claimed on the individual tax returns, that lowers the state, the Oregon income tax paid by these businesses, and potentially is a workaround that $10,000 limit. This is modeled after a New Jersey plan, New Jersey law that's been in effect. And since 2018, a number of states have tried to come up with a workaround for that SALT limitation. This plan copies New Jersey and proposes it for Oregon. It would be revenue neutral to the state because the amount of tax collected at the entity level would then be offset perfectly by tax refundable tax credits claimed by the business owners. And some of the discussion that the committee was getting into last time was with respect to the legal implications. And we have Kate Toswell from Legislative Council. Some of the questions that came up at the first meeting that we started to get into, or that the committee started to get into, was the lack of a 3/5 on here, and whether or not these two policies, the tax credit and the tax, could be separated in the future or just permanently linked together. So, Madam Chair, I think that's where we left off, although there was ongoing discussion. So I think the intent is to have Kate kind of pick up those issues. I don't know how you wanted to move forward with that.
I think what we'll do is start off with the testimony that we had last session at our last meeting, and get that on the record. Hopefully as close as it occurred at last week. And then we'll get into the analysis with Kate Toswell. And thank you for being here, Kate. So I will start out by calling Greg Peden.
Afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Greg Peden here today on behalf of a number of small business entities that I represent. Thank you for the time to be here. I think Chris covered the overall pretty well. I want to add just a little bit of flavor to it. The limitation, the $10,000 limitations in place now, was part of the 2018 federal tax package, and the $10,000 limitation was really put in by the Trump administration. It's really hit income tax states, and as Chris said, a number of states have already created this workaround. New Jersey is one, Massachusetts is another, Connecticut is another. So it's not an an unusual thing that is occurring here. The IRS provided guidance on how to do this fall. That's where was reported in the national media about that, and that's where we first learned about the opportunity to do this. Second, I want to reemphasize that this proposal is revenue neutral to the state of Oregon. I think that's a huge part of the consideration here, that this is, you're still paying your state and local taxes. It's just the deduction off your federal taxes that this is making available to. So it's a good deal for small businesses in the state. I think it's a good deal for the state of Oregon. So happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Okay, are there questions? Somebody's not on mute and they've got their cell phone ringing, it sounds like.
That was me, Madam Chair, I apologize.
Oh, okay, well, that's okay because you were speaking. okay, are there questions of Mr. Peden? Okay, thank you. And we will move to our next witness, Bennett Minton.
Am I on now? Okay. Madam Chair.
Yes.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you.
Bennett, you're breaking up. I'm wondering if you should go on audio, whether that might improve your reception. You're kind of freezing up.
Yeah, I was noticing on the previous testimony. Let me turn off my video there. How's that? We'll see if that works better.
That seems to be better. So go ahead with your testimony.
Perfect. You don't need to see me anyway. Joining me in drafting our testimony was Brenda Gilmer, a tax lawyer and former official.
Wait, would you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Oh, again. Okay, sure. I'm Bennett Minton, speaking on behalf of Tax Fairness Oregon, a network of volunteers who advocate for a rational and equitable tax code. Joining me in drafting our testimony was Brenda Gilmer, a tax lawyer and former official in Montana's Revenue Department. We spent a couple of hours over the weekend discussing the -1 amendment and its implications, and we are deeply concerned. Many of us agree on the narrative behind the 2017 Tax Act. With respect to this subject, Congress had a political aim: harming taxpayers in predominantly blue states by limiting the SALT deduction. Commentary reported that Republicans wanted to pressure Democratic states to cut taxes and the services that fund them. As you know, many states tried workarounds and they didn't fly with the IRS. Now, apparently, the IRS has signed off on a New Jersey regime, which is the basis of this amendment. The IRS also issued an NPRM in December. In a related release, the IRS said, and I'll quote it, "The proposed regulations will clarify that state and local income taxes imposed on and paid by a partnership or S-corp on its income are allowed as a deduction by the partnership or S-corp in computing its non-separately stated taxable income or loss for the taxable year of payment, and therefore are not subject to the state and local tax deduction limitation for partners and shareholders who itemize deductions." In other words, contrary to the plain meaning of what Congress said, states may create a workaround that allows certain taxpayers, owners of some pass-throughs, to take an unlimited SALT deduction on their pass-through income. You have before you a proposal that purports to do that. we have two sets of issues with it. One, the Senate and House Revenue Committees have been devoting attention this year to bills that would curtail the preferential tax treatment Oregon Accords pass-throughs, an effort we wholeheartedly endorse. The effort, contrary to the pass-through preference, is consistent with Oregon Revised Statute Section 316.003, providing for, quote, the same tax burden on all households earning the same income, unquote. And yet, the committee is considering how to make the federal SALT deduction work for some small set of taxpayers, those with the money and sophistication to weigh an annual election to shift tax liability to the pass-through entity and away from its individual owners. We could argue about the SALT deduction, whether it encourages states to tax its citizens and how it contributes to unequal tax burdens. But looking just at this proposal, we're having trouble with the inconsistency of your deliberations. Let's review the 2017 Tax Act in broad strokes. It favored capital over labor income. The law cut the corporate tax rate, created a roughly equivalent deduction for pass-through income, slashed the application of the estate tax, and offered a pittance of tax relief to some middle and lower income wage workers. It shifted income up and the tax burden down. It looks to us like you're participating in that effort rather than defending the principle that income is income and should be so taxed. The second concern is how this regime works in the real world. In the committee's March 17 hearing, which I watched over the weekend, all 23 minutes, including the alarms that the hearing was not being broadcast, legislative counsel asserted that this regime would be revenue neutral because the tax credit to individuals would be offset by the tax paid at the entity level. That may be so in an academic setting. Brenda spent many years as a tax regulator. I spent many years involved in federal corporate tax. From our perspectives, a class of taxpayers and their advisors are responsible for a certain percentage of GDP in gaming the tax system. My former colleagues maneuver our clients through this cat and mouse game with the IRS and state authorities. In this case, we are concerned that partnerships may game the regime to lower the aggregate tax in ways that the state could not possibly effectively. This is because S corporations are limited to ascribing prorated distributive shares of the entity's items of income, deduction, and credit to its shareholders, but partnerships are not so limited. Under the proposed regime, the state potentially would sanction a Pandora's box for shifting counterbalancing income streams to individual partners, be they individuals, S corps, C corps, trusts, or estates, based on their unique abilities to avoid Oregon tax. This regime would be effective beginning next year and therefore apply to receipts in 2023. New president and Congress, and they're going to be dealing with the SALT deduction in some form. The IRS will have new priorities, perhaps shifting its stance in the rulemaking announced a few days after the 2020 election. We understand that you're dealing with the world as it is and not as it may be. But for all these reasons, we urge you to set this proposal aside. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. There were a couple times where your talking was garbled. So if you have your testimony written out, would you please put it on the record if it's not already there?
Yes, ma'am. I was going to wait until after we take into consideration everything that we hear today before I submit, but we're very pleased to do so. Thank you.
Thank you. And like I say, it wasn't enough to stop you, but there were just a few words garbled there. We want to make sure we get it accurate, everything you said. Okay. Are there questions from the committee? Okay. I see no questions. So now we will, with help from Chris, we will get into our colloquy with Kate Toswell on the revenue implications and the three-fifths implications of this. So, Chris, help me out here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So, Kate Toswell is available to talk from the legal perspective, and there were two primary issues. The first one is why this bill doesn't need the three-fifths. So I think that, so in a second, I'll, Kate, well, maybe we'll just take it in order. That was the first issue. Why doesn't it need a 3/5?
Okay, welcome, Kate.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. I'm Kate Tossel from the Office of Legislative Counsel, and addressing Senate Bill 727, the -1 amendments, which again are gut and stuff amendments and replace the entire content of the introduced bill. These amendments would both impose an entity level tax on certain pass-through entities, and then at the individual owner or shareholder level, there would be a new credit that's established. That's also in the -1 amendments. And in looking at a bill and determining whether a bill is a bill for raising revenue for either of the two provisions in the Oregon Constitution that address bills for raising revenue. Those are the origination clause, whether a bill needs to be a House bill and originate in the House, and then also the supermajority provision, whether a bill requires a 3/5 majority or can pass with a simple majority. For those two provisions, the analysis is the same. There are several cases that we look to from the Oregon Supreme Court and the Oregon Tax Court, but the main concept is that we look to the case Bobo versus Kulongoski. And under Bobo, there's a two-step analysis that's used. The first step is we look at whether the bill actually brings money into the Treasury. And if we determine in looking at the bill that it will not bring money into the Treasury, we do not proceed to the second step. If a bill actually brings money into the state Treasury, we'll move to the second step. And that step, the second prong of Bobo, is to determine whether the bill has the essential features of a bill levying a tax. So therefore, we can have a bill that brings money into the state Treasury, but in fact is not a bill for raising revenue and can be either a House bill or a Senate bill and can pass with a simple majority. Under 727-1, even though I caution that this is, my understanding is this is preliminary as far as the rates and the applicability dates and so forth, but under this framework where we provide both a new entity level tax and then a corresponding offsetting credit for the shareholders, the bill will not bring money into the state Treasury. So we move to the first prong of the Bobo versus Kulongoski test, and we go no further. So for those reasons, this would not be a bill for raising revenue. Again, I caution if there were other changes, the analysis might be different. But my understanding is the purpose, the point of this bill is that it would move the liability from the entity level, from the owners to the entity level. And because there is not the SALT limitation on the entity level tax, it would enable the owners to take full advantage of their deduction on their federal taxes. It would have more of an impact actually at the federal level because the point is to adjust the federal tax burden. And I think, as has already been mentioned, this is the one approach that, as of now, has been endorsed by the Internal Revenue Service. They have issued guidance last fall indicating that this was an approach that they would support. There have been other approaches, other ways that states have tried to address the state and local tax limitation from the 2017 legislation, and those approaches have not necessarily been successful with the IRS. So if that, with that, if I can take questions on the initial question, the 3/5 question or the supermajority question.
Okay, are there questions on that aspect of it from the committee? I see none. Thank you, Kate. And then Chris, what was the second thing that we would like to talk about?
Madam Chair, the second issue was the ability to permanently link, if that's the right phrase, permanently link the tax with the credits moving into the future, and the ability to just have them permanently linked, I guess, is the easiest way to say that.
And of course, that potentially goes crosswise of the constitutional requirement that one legislature cannot commit another legislature. So, Kate, have you had a chance to look into that?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, that's exactly right. And the way that currently, the way that the Dash 1 amendments are drafted, Section 3, which imposes the new, Section 2 imposes the entity level tax, and that would apply going forward. Section 3 is a new credit, which is a personal income tax credit. And in keeping with, Section 3, I'm looking at them in the wrong order. Section 3 is the credit, and it would be ongoing. They are both in this amendment. So at this point, if they were voted on, they would both be in effect, but there is nothing that would prevent a future legislature from taking. We can't bind a future legislature, so a future legislature could act in whatever way to eliminate one or the other. One thing I would note that is not really addressed in the Dash 1, and I don't think that we discussed, I believe it was last week, the limitation that was in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act is itself temporary. And it goes through the 2025 tax year. So one approach might be to make both of them, because they would want to, the intention would be to line them up, is to have them both apply through the 2025 tax year. One of the considerations is that with all tax expenditures, there's a provision in Chapter 315 that provides the tax expenditure is to last for 6 tax years, unless there's an express other period of applicability that's provided by the legislature. And that could be shorter or longer, but if the legislation is silent, the automatic applicability will be for 6 years. And so that is something that I think people are used to seeing at this point, this 6-year provisions, and they are considered, they're taken up in groups of 3, so that each long session, there's a third of them that are inspected. But it might make sense to actually put this on a timetable where it matches the current federal provision, the SALT limitation, if you will, and have both of them go through the 2025 tax year. But no, there isn't anything that the legislature could do in the 2021 long session that would prevent a future legislature from taking whatever action it chose going forward, repealing, extending, or what have you.
So we couldn't just say if one is repealed, then the other is automatically repealed. We couldn't do that.
Chair Burdick, we could do that, but the future legislature could, in fact, amend that provision. So anything short of the Constitution is not permanent in that sense, for the most part. A current legislature cannot bind a future legislature.
Okay. All right. Senator Boquist.
Thank you. Let me go back to the first question, which applies to the second question, which then applies to the 2025. I read the notice that that council put up. I found it online. It's one of the advantages of, I guess, being here in the Capitol. And it very clearly applies to both LLC partnerships, S-Corp, so on and so forth. So it applies to everybody, it appears. We heard testimony that said, well, experience testimony will say that, you know, it could be gamed and it might apply to some and not apply to others. I don't see that in the notice, but if it would apply to one and it would not apply to another, then it is in fact passes the first test of Bobo. So, and I actually agree with counsel that it's probably not a tax in the reading, but I'm curious, Kate, have you looked at the notice and do you concur with what I just said, is this applies equally to partnerships and S-Corp? So one, there's no advantage over one over the other that I can read in the notice. Do you read it the same way?
Chair Burdick, Senator Boquist, I'm not aware of which notice is in question. One thing I would caution is, my understanding of this provision is that it is intended and designed to be revenue neutral, in that regardless of which taxpayers can take or which types of entities can or elect to take advantage of it, my understanding is it is set up not to either lose or gain revenue for the state. And I think if it were, if there's a future amendment, so not the dash one, but if there's a dash three or a dash four that's structured differently, it's potentially the analysis would change. But my understanding at this point is it's not intended to either gain or lose revenue for the state. It's intended for personal income taxpayers to be able to, in a way, work around the federal SALT limitation. But I apologize, I'm not aware of the notice in question. So if there's a maybe a follow-up.
Yeah, follow-up, Madam Chair, if you would.
Please do.
I'm trying to eliminate, because you heard the testimony earlier where there it said, you know, it would apply differently to different entities. And of course, if that were the case, and I would encourage, and I'll email you a copy of the notice so you can look at it. I don't think it does. I don't think it's a tax. I'm in agreement with there, but we have testimony that sort of says the opposite, that it would in fact raise or lower different people's taxes. Back to the question though of sunsetting it, and if the existing law sunsets in 2025, then could it not be sunsetted in 2025, or a clause placed in there that it has to be compatible with federal law? And so let's say, for example, in 2022, if the present Congress changed the law, then it would, of course, null and void it. It would sunset by that change. Is that feasible to do it that way?
Chair Burdick, Senator Boquist, at this point, we have the federal law is temporary. It applies to the 2025 tax year. We can design our provisions so it addresses the problem that it sets out to solve, which is the state and local tax limitation. We cannot anticipate and delegate. Part of the reason that we have the reconnect bill that we have each year is because we cannot tie to a future action of another sovereign. So we cannot anticipate federal changes in federal law. All we can do, other than we tie to the definition of taxable income. So if we could anticipate perfectly what the change is that's only going to affect the definition of taxable income, that's the one place where we can tie. But other changes that may be happening, we need to act retrospectively or at least concurrently, because we cannot delegate to how Congress is acting. We can put... Go ahead.
I'm trying to get you to state the same thing you're saying, but in a different manner, okay? What I'm trying to do is say if we sunset this in 2025 and we're connected to the federal statutes and the federal IRC, and they change that code and it's no longer compatible, it becomes the legislature has to act again to either reconnect it or make it compatible. Is that not correct? That's the whole purpose of
Chair Burdick, Senator Boquist, that is the whole purpose of reconnecting, so right, that we are able to inspect what Congress is doing and make choices whether we are going to pick up the changes. There are certain changes that are picked up automatically, but many of them we have to actually act and update the dates in the statutes. So it sounds like we're in agreement to that point.
Third question, Madam Chair. I don't know the answer to this, and I don't know you know the answer to this, and we're not in Ohio, so we haven't read their case law or their filings yet. At least I haven't. Maybe you have. Okay. This is a credit, and the American whatever they call this thing that came from Washington, D.C. with all these checks and money and cash says you can't do credits, you can't do this, so on and so forth. Since it's neutral, is it not a credit, or is it a credit, or how does the federal clause that says we can't do credits pertain to this or not pertain to this proposal?
Chair Burdick, Senator Boquist, that is a good question. And that's, I think, something we were talking about, maybe it was last week or the week before. In looking at that, the provision in question in the American Rescue Plan Act, that provision actually says the state may not lower its tax collection, lower its revenue by taking one of these steps. So yes, there is litigation out of the state of Ohio has filed a motion for a preliminary injunction, and I believe other states may be following course. But aside from that, if something is not lowering the revenues received by a state, I don't know that you look to whether there's actually a credit that's being enacted as part of that. I don't know that provision would come into play, because the idea is that a state should not enact a tax cut. And this, again, is not intended as a tax cut.
Well, we'd want to make sure when the rules come out that we are safe on that. And this is not the only issue where we're going to be worried about this. We're going to be worried about this on renewal of tax credits and the, you know, whether we have even an option to adopt new tax credits. So thank you for bringing that up, Senator Boquist. The other, one of the follow-ups that I had to some of the points Senator Boquist was raising is, do we stand a risk of if we sunset this, say in 2025, and the Congress acts in 2022, Do we have any risk that their actions could cause us to get into the territory of either raising or reducing revenue?
Chair Burdick, I think this might end up being a very factually dense question, but it occurs to me that if the action on the part of Congress is specific to, say, increasing the threshold of the SALT limitation, the limitation on state and local tax, the state and local tax deduction, or removing it entirely earlier than scheduled, because currently it's the 2025 tax year, it would seem that the response to that, the taxpayer response to that, is more likely to be not to elect to use this. I mean, this is an entirely elective regime where there would be the entity level tax that's imposed and then essentially passed through to the owners, the shareholders, and the corresponding personal income tax credit. But if the limitation goes away, the motivation for being able to use this seems to be diminished. I'd caution the details, again, could be significant and this could be factually dense, but it seems as if that wouldn't be the necessary outcome if all that's happening is the limitation is either raised or it's eliminated altogether. And I don't know if LRO has any more thoughts on that. Again, it would be factually specific as to the action that Congress took.
Okay, well, you mentioned on the subject of sunsets, one thing that just crosses my mind off the top of my head, not to mix my metaphors, is possibly setting a very short sunset. You know, for example, one of the things committee will be considering is whether if we do this to make it retroactive to the last tax year. So setting a very tight sunset, like, you know, a year or two, so that we wouldn't get into the issue that Senator Finley raised, which is how do we prevent the legislature from taking one piece or another out of it? And if we sunsetted it, it put a very tight sunset on it, that would solve the problem of, you know, changes, potential changes at the federal level, and also it would get around the issue of binding a future legislature, because the legislature would have to take up the issue afresh and decide whether to continue with something, which hopefully, if we adopt it, of course, it has to be successful. And so the chances would be good of a renewal, but it would allow more scrutiny of how it's working. Are there other questions from the committee or comments? Okay, well, we will take this under advisement. And like I said, we are looking into, with Chris's help, the ability, if we chose to make it retroactive to a previous tax year, or I guess just one tax year. Is that right, Chris?
Would probably, potentially could go back to tax year 2018.
Okay. All right. So we will be looking at that. So so don't be surprised if you see this emerge, but we're in the analysis phase now. So, okay. Are there other questions from the committee or comments? All right. It's our short agenda, so thank you very much, everyone, and we are adjourned.